Welcome. My name is Dan Koonin. It's my great privilege to be the athletic director here at Santa Clara University. And I want to welcome you all to our program here today, again, hosted by the Markulis Center for Applied Ethics, by the Santa Clara Athletic Department, and by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. It is my great pleasure to be able to introduce our guest today. It is Mike Pereira. He presently serves as a Fox Television sports analyst. He provides the expert commentary on instant replay, officiating, and rules issues each Sunday. He, in 1982, became an NCAA football official. In 1996, became an NFL official, and in 1998, quickly rose to become the NFL's supervisor of officials. In 2004, he was named vice president in charge of all officiating matters within the league. He retired from the NFL in 2009 and became an on-air officiating analyst for Fox Sports NFL. He does a remarkable job of simplifying the very complex issues that come up with instant replay and with the officials' issues. And, of course, on this campus, he's also remembered as a center fielder for the Broncos, which he was from 68 to 72, and got a degree here in finance. He's here to address some of the very timely issues that have come up recently. The NFL is at a little bit of a crossroads with all the focus on the concussions lately, and now with some of the things that came out in the last few weeks about the New Orleans Saints, issues of what is competition, of what the rules should be, of health issues for the athletes involved. It all comes together, and who better than Mike to address some of this for us today. We're so pleased to have him, and I want to welcome back to campus Mike Pereira.
It's very nice to be here, and it's been a long time since I've been here, by the way. This place does not look the same. You know, when I was in school here, when the El Camino Real ran right through the middle of campus, and you know, you had to walk across the El Camino to get to the library from, like, Benswig Hall, where I lived. I never went to the library very much, so I wasn't much in danger. But it is really changed, and it's neat to come back here. And when Rusty Weeks, a.k.a. Buckets is what they called him when he played at Santa Clara, Michael Cole would know. Buckets, why did they call you Buckets? Because you were so slow. It was like you were dragging a bucket behind you when you ran. Yeah. Of course, my nickname was Blue Jay and Chicken Man. And how did the Blue Jay and the Chicken Man, how did those two relate? Because I had bird legs and I could run fast, but my legs were something to behold. But, great to be here. When Rusty actually called me about this and he mentioned the word talk, and when David talked to him, he mentioned the word talk, and talk to me is always a little bit different than a speech. A speech to me is something that I lay out and I have a starting point and an ending point, and a talk is just a talk and is just to kind of share some thoughts that I might have and it's actually a little bit more difficult to do, although I gave it four times on the way from Sacramento this morning in the car. But it's just more of a thought about, or just really a sharing of some of the feelings that I have. And I was telling my wife, it's actually so neat to come to Santa Clara to do it, because I've never, in any talk I've given, you know, there's no real connection. There's no connection, no mental connection necessarily to me, whether if I'm at the North Point Rotary Club, you know, where I was at last week, you know, there's no personal feeling. Here there is. And, you know, here probably the two events that shaped my life happened here at Santa Clara. and they're not what you would expect. And I, you know, and I think, should I share those? Well, yeah, I probably will. But, you know, to think of being here, you know, from 68 to 72 and a half or 72 and a quarter or whatever it was, thanks to Mrs. Tsai and her quantitative methods class that I couldn't pass and still have nightmares about. But to think that from there to where I am now is really pretty amazing. To think that I'm on television. I mean, and to think I have wardrobe and I have makeup on Sundays, Saturdays and Sundays, you know, is pretty amazing. And to think that I have a little bit of notoriety and sometimes you get recognized. Does anybody here, and maybe not, but has anybody ever watched the show Storage Wars? There is a guy on Storage Wars named Barry Weiss who looks a lot like me. And, you know, it gets really frustrating for people walking up to you and say, are you Barry Weiss? And it happened just a couple weeks ago with my wife. We were flying to Salt Lake City, unbeknownst to me, from Sacramento. It was Southwest. We went through Portland and had a three-hour delay in Portland for mechanical. And we were back on the plane and I was next to the window, my wife's in the middle seat, and then some guy is on the aisle seat, and the flight attendant came up and leaned over and said to me, can I ask you a question? And I said, sure. She goes, are you on TV? And I said, yes. And she goes, are you Barry Weiss? And I said, no. And that was it. But then, and then at the South Point or North Point Rotary last week at the Sheraton Hotel in Sacramento, I gave my talk, and then I had to get my parking ticket validated. And so I had to go to the front desk to do it. And I went to this young man at the front desk, and he validated my ticket. And he said, I recognize you from somewhere. And so I just said, do you watch Storage Wars? He goes, that's it. That's it. So I have this complex, even though I am on TV a little bit. But anyways, so, you know, I asked David a couple of times, you know, what the makeup of the audience was going to be. And it's just exactly what he said. It was going to be a combination of students and former students, Barb, to see that I haven't seen in decades, obviously, and faculty members and stuff like that. So a real varied group, and just a little bit about me and Santa Clara, and maybe the two things that the two events, I guess, that shaped my life more than my finance major here. You know, I was a finance major, which in the end in football didn't seem to make a lot of rhyme or reason. But event number one really happened in 1971, and I was a junior. And it wasn't anything to do with any class that I was in. It was everything to do with the fact that we only went to school 4 days a week. We had Wednesdays off because the Jesuits just plied us with so much work that we needed an extra day, a full day during the middle of the week to study. Well, Tuesday night became another Friday night, and Pedro games were played, and beer was drank. So you needed a little bit more money for beer money than your normal people that just partied on Friday and Saturday night. I didn't have any. And so somebody came to me and said, you could officiate football. Go referee football to make some extra money. You could go there looking for officials to go to East Palo Alto at Ravenswood and do Pop Warner football games for $10 a game, three games on Sunday, $30 cash, 1971. It appealed to me. The $30 cash appealed to me. And so I decided to do it. And it was incredible because first trip to Ravenswood, not the best area, by the way, but first trip to Ravenswood, first time on a field with kids. I don't know. I don't know what it was. I'm not totally sure. But it was like somebody stuck a syringe in me and filled me with adrenaline. It captivated me. And I don't know if it was just being with the kids or if I don't really know what it was, but it immediately became a passion. Strange as it may seem, football officiating became a passion. In 1971, in my junior year at Santa Clara. And then in 1975, I was long gone after my 4 1/3 years of schooling here, whatever it was, but came back to Santa Clara. And I worked in the athletic department as an assistant baseball coach doing some promotion work. And when I did, in 1975, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer. Probably the hardest time of my life because it was not as known as Lance Armstrong has now made it. I remember going to Dr. Belogorsky in Los Gatos, California, and he talked to me for 45 minutes and said, "I can't help you. This is over my head." And that alone freaked me out. I was further freaked out when later that afternoon his bill showed up in my mailbox in Los Gatos. Hand delivered my bill into our mailbox. Made you wonder how long you had to live. Went to O'Connor Hospital. They said, "We can't. It's above us." And that was it for me. Then I was a basket case from that point on. And, of course, then I got a referral to Stanford University, to their medical center. And they were unbelievable. And in 3 days, I mean, I had the surgery done, the testicle removed, into the program for the radiation treatments, 24 of them straight, and which certainly there was some suffering as you got through that thing. And when I finished, I think I quit. I think I ran, and I think nothing was important to me anymore. Certainly nothing was important to me professionally. And I'm speaking to the students a little bit, and then I'm going to get into the game. I escaped and went to Alaska and did some broadcasting, radio broadcasting, you know, on a 50,000 watt radio station, doing the play by play for the Anchorage Glacier Pilot baseball team. 50,000 watts. That's like a lot of watts, man. 50,000 watts here and you're going to reach millions and millions of people. 50,000 watts in Anchorage, Alaska, you reached about 75,000 because there weren't many people up there really. But I kind of just quit. Came back, I floated around, I did some things, I was not into anything, I didn't want to do anything. I wanted to just kind of just float by in life. And the interesting part of this whole thing was, I still had my passion. I still had my passion from 1971 at Santa Clara. I did. Football officiating was my life. It was the one thing that brought me pleasure. It was the one thing that made me feel unique. And then in 1996, I truly believe, you know, because of my passion, in 1996, after 14 years of officiating football in the National Football, after 14 years of officiating football in Division I college football, I got the call from the NFL that said, "You're in. We're bringing you in." And I was like, wow, 1996, 46 years old, and I got a call from the National Football League to become an official. Hadn't saved a dime. I didn't have a dime in a savings account. Married, but not a dime. And it was like my moons lined up in 1996. when I got this opportunity. My moons lined up. And it was 46 years before my passion really became calling. And in 1946, I embarked on a journey that took me to New York for 12 years, living in the Upper East Side in Manhattan. I spent 2 years on the field in the NFL and then 12 years in the office running the officiating program of the National Football League. My passion. Wasn't a day. There wasn't a day that I didn't wake up in New York on the Upper East Side and say, I'm ready. I'm ready to go to work. I'm working my passion. I mean, it's incredible. And I say that to students nowadays. You got to find a passion and you got to be patient and you got to try to find a way to live your passion and spend as much time as you can following and being a part of your passion. I'm so lucky to have been given the opportunities that I have because I was involved in my passion. Because I think in 1971 I went to Ravenswood to do a Pop Warner game, and because in 1975 I was diagnosed with cancer, and all of a sudden, really to me then, what became important really was most important, which was my passion and my family and those types of things. And so I go through all of that. Where can you hit this button? Who is going to hit this button to start this video? So I go from all of this, and then this is what I end up with after my education at Santa Clara and my time with Fox. This is what I end up with. We'll see if it works. Oh, we got a volume. Anybody watch Curb Your Enthusiasm? So we don't get volume. Anyways, this was my commercial that I did with J.B. Smoove. And they cloned me. If you can watch it through and I'll describe it. The idea was I'm the most knowledgeable guy in rules. And what happened if something happened to me? They'd have to clone me. So they cloned me in the commercial. They make a zillion baby Mike Peas. So this is what my education got me at the University of Santa Clara. So where are we in sports now? Where are we in football? I mean, you know, I got more intrigued with looking at applied ethics than I did at football after Rusty had talked to me and David talked to me and really kind of, I don't think about behavior. I don't think about right and wrong behavior. I really don't. I mean, and I don't really in sports, but you know, as I started looking at ethics and applied ethics and, you know, and I thought about behavior, I'm thinking about, you know, where are we? Where are we in this game? You know, what I look at it and say, does football bring out the best or the worst in the players, in the coaches, in the fans, and probably most dear to my heart, to the officials? I mean, where are we? I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't think I've ever been involved. I mean, I've been involved in football since 1971. I certainly have never seen it go through what it's going through now in terms of the cultural change of the game. And that's what's going on. You know, football's interesting. If you go back and look at the history of the game, if you go back in 1906, Teddy Roosevelt almost banned the game. He was going to ban the game. Now, football was invented in the 1800s. It was a kind of combination when they put together. They saw soccer and rugby, and they wanted to do something to kind of make an American version of it, and they came up with this game of football without rules. There were no rules. And in 1906, Teddy Roosevelt almost banned it because of the fact there were 18 fatalities in 1905 and an unbelievable amount of injuries. And so Teddy Roosevelt said, we either ban it or we come up with some rules to make it safer. 1906. Pretty fascinating. To fast forward to 2012 and see that we're basically at the same culture right now. I mean, you're looking at a sport, and the NFL will refute this, but there are enough studies that have been conducted. You're looking at a sport that takes the average lifespan of a man who plays in the league for 5 years, which is the average length of an NFL player's career. His average lifespan is in the range of 55 years old. 20 years less than the lifespan of a man that didn't. 20 years. Now, the NFL will dispute that, and they have, and said that there's now some proven stories that the average lifespan is 62 or something. I don't care if it's 62 or I don't care if it's 55, but whatever. It's a lot shorter than the guy that doesn't play football. And you're going through a cultural change because you really do have a commissioner right now when you talk about behavior who cares about two things. He cares about the integrity of the game, and he cares about the safety of the players. He does. He wants people playing. He doesn't want people on injured reserve lists or PUPs, physically unable to perform lists. He wants players to play. And so he is attacking a culture that has been prevalent in the league for decades. And really, he's kind of said, okay, we're going to do everything we can to protect the thing that we can't live without, which is our head, and to protect the mind, and which probably certainly affects the lifespan of the former players who you read about, you know, who are passing at age 55 with dementia and all of the brain type syndromes from the injuries that they've had. And he's like, to me, he is highlighted in our sport of football a concern in many other sports. I mean, you look at hockey and say, my God, look at the concussion thing in hockey, that if they want to go and if they do go back and look at that, and they're all doing it to a degree. But you look at hockey, you know, I think someday people are going to say, we got a problem with soccer. Heading balls, you know, low-grade concussions that probably don't even register, that will manifest themselves later down the road. I think that the culture change that the league is going through now, the NFL is going through, is a good one. But it's hard to sell. It's hard to sell to fans. Hard to sell to fans who really, come on, they like to go to the game and see big hits. They like to watch it on TV and see big hits. Fans like to watch a hockey game to see fights. Fans like to go to auto races to see wrecks. Fans are flocking to MMA, mixed martial arts, to see guys beat the crap out of each other. It makes you think about behaviors a little bit. And then you go to the NFL and you get criticized. And this is what always interests me is, and what has me a bit perplexed. You get criticized by current players for the rules that you institute to protect them, you get criticized for making the game too soft. And at the same time, you get sued by over 200 former players who are suing you because of their concussion syndromes and that they have. And they're suing you because they said you didn't do anything about it and you knew about it all along. So you got the current group saying you're making the game too soft, and then you got the ex group that's saying you didn't do enough when you knew about it. It's like if the NFL, you're going, and then you get Congress that jumps in and says, if you don't do something about it, we'll take away your antitrust legislation. It's really pretty amazing to me. It's amazing. It's amazing that, you know, that you're in this situation, you know, and then you get a law and order. I call him a sheriff. I call Goodell a sheriff. I do. I think he is a sheriff. I think he is. He's a politician. His dad was a senator. Who cares so much about the integrity of the game and so much about player safety that he's doing something about it. And he gets criticized. You want to know something? I was with him for about 12 years. He doesn't care if he gets criticized. He doesn't care. And then when he finds an opportunity to protect the integrity of the game or to protect players, if he finds a way, look out. Two examples, 2008 or whatever it was, the New England Patriots were caught taping the Jets' plays on the field to use them for coaching purposes. Now, we're not talking player safety issue here, but we are talking something that is against the rules. It's against the bylaws of the league. You cannot film during the game. They were caught. It was rumored. They were warned, and then they were caught. I was in the office when they got caught. It was unbelievable. Now, come on. I mean, now they're just filming plays. How much could they use? I don't know. I really don't know how much benefit, but they certainly could have had some. I got the video. I was the first one to get the video, and it was like the biggest Hollywood screening you could ever have in my office. Everybody came, and it was a cassette thing. It was like a cassette player. Mike Cole would know all about this video stuff. I stuck that cassette thing into my machine at my desk up onto the big screen. Nothing. Blank. I thought they were going to kill me. Like it was my fault. It was blank. I said, this was in the box. I opened the sealed box. Well, then I figured out, oh, they never took the tape out of the camera. You know, so I went into the camera and pulled the tape out, put it in, and then there it was. There was all the evidence of them. That what they would do is they would shoot the clock. And then they'd shoot the clock and the down and distance, then the play, then the cheerleaders, and then the clock and the next play. It was bizarre, but they were caught. They were caught. They broke the rules. He massacred them. He fined the team $500,000. He fined Belichick $250,000. He took away a first round draft choice. He's a sheriff. So when the bounty thing comes in 2010 and the rumors of the bounty comes up in 2010, yeah, bounty, you didn't use that word. In the league office, that was two words that if you wanted to get the commissioner mad, get him upset, get him riled, say bounty or gambling. That's the two things for integrity of the game that he would be like. And you know what? There was rumors of bounties, although some were different. I mean, a bounty is basically, you know, you're paying a guy to do something, and a bounty could be as little as basically, you know, not letting your quarterback get hit as a left tackle, and they pay you an incentive bonus, which is kind of like a bounty is, all against the rules, by the way. You can't have one incentive for a player. I can't say to a player, if I was a coach, I can say, hey, listen, I'll, you, you, uh, you run for 25 yards today, and I'll let you wear my $25 Timex watch. Can't if it's not in his contract. Every little incentive has to be in the player's contract. But bounties were so hard to prove, and there was rumors of it. They looked at it in 2010. They couldn't prove it, so onward they went. They warned them. Up came a stoolie, a whistleblower, which I thought, my God, how could they have a bounty? Knowing how illegal that is and knowing how that sends the wrong message, how could you do a bounty when you think, hey, God, I got all these strapping guys here. They used to play football at this school, by the way. But if I had a team here and these were my guys, if I said to you guys, hey, the first one to get Brett Favre, money, baby, money. And you'd say, let's keep it hush hush. But, you know, you hit Brett Favre, but you didn't really hurt him, but you thought you deserved the $1,000 and you didn't get it. And then I cut you the next year and you're pissed. You're going to blow the whistle. How can you be so stupid? I mean, I say this, but I shouldn't say this because it's on radio, but I would, if based on what's happened with New Orleans, don't you have to kind of question? You kind of have to question the overall IQ of the National Football League, the people that play in it and coach it. It's that stupid to me. And the fact is, knowing all of this protection of players and what Goodell is trying to do to actually give money to take people out of the game legally. We're not talking illegally here. We're talking legally, to pay a guy to hit a guy so hard that, and you call it a cart off? They got to cart him off in a cart or a kill? I would have paid to be there when Goodell was told. Would have loved to have been there, because I know he had to go crazy. And he was going to do the same thing he did. He's going to do the same thing to the Saints that he did with the Patriots. He's going to crush them. You wouldn't like to hear me say that. So I hope he's not listening to this radio broadcast when it shows. But he was going to crush them. He was going to make an example out of them the same way that he made an example out of the Patriots. There ain't nobody filming on the sidelines anymore. And any coach that thinks he might be running, that thinks you want to run a bounty system, yeah, I don't think that'd be a good idea. Because Greg Williams, the guy that kind of ran the whole thing, is out indefinitely. What's indefinitely mean? Well, indefinitely means, you know, I think I'm going to, if I'm trying to be inside of Goodell's head, I think I'm going to try to find some more proof that he did some things in Buffalo and Washington and maybe extend it for more than a year. Well, he got his proof. He got his proof in the audio tapes before the San Francisco game when he told him to hit Smith here and take out the outside ACL of Crabtree. Now, Buckets played football. I mean, maybe. He was involved in football. It's a violent game. And you motivate players. And I think players try to hit people hard to intimidate them. I don't think to hurt them. I mean, you shouldn't try to hurt them. And I think that this is part of the culture that Goodell is trying to change. It's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. And I think he has to change it. Because if he doesn't, hey, guess what? I've been involved in this game a long time now. I don't have any children. If I did, I'm not so sure I'd have them play the game. And I hate to be the pessimist, but if you look at some of the participation on the high school level of football, not that strong. In many areas, not that strong. Not a lot of kids playing. If they don't play in high school, you got less kids to go to college. And you don't play in college, you got nobody to go to the NFL. You don't you don't have a game. And I think that you have to be concerned about that. And I think the second cultural change that's going on, which Goodell is also supportive of, but has not gone far enough in my mind, is sportsmanship. And this nonsense, I'm a bit of a purist, this nonsense of what people do on the playing field to show themselves to the world. The Chad Ochocinco is now bad, that's back to Chad Johnson or whatever it is, and the Terrell Owens and these guys that, you know, prepare these skits after they score a touchdown with total disregard to me to the quarterback that threw him the pass or the blockers that blocked for the quarterback to give him time to throw the pass. I think it's awful. And I've always thought it's awful because these athletes are role models. Their behavior is going to be copied. I mean, the first guy that ever did this, you know who did? That's a throat slash. You get up, you make a play, and you do this. A throat slash. First player that ever did it. Brett Favre. 3 weeks after he did it. It was amazing. 3 weeks after he did it for the first time. And we did address it to him. It wasn't listed in the rule book. 3 weeks after he did it, a high school official from somewhere here in California sent us a tape to look at. We wanted, can you critique my performance? Yeah, we had a lot of time to critique his performance. High school official sent it in. We looked at a few plays. A defensive player sacks a quarterback, gets up. Same thing Brett Favre did 3 weeks ago. And that's, I think, my point that I always try to make with the league, and they have done they've gone part way, and I'm proud of that, but they got to clean up that nonsense, this ESPN mentality that all I want to do is be on the ESPN highlight show. I think that's the second cultural change that is involved, that the league is going through. And I just think we all have to look as fans. I'm now kind of gone back to a fan. It's interesting. Now that I've been out for 2 years and on the television side, I'm not a media person. I mean, what I do is ridiculous. I mean, you know, I could get up in front of, if something really complicated happened on the football field, I could go on TV right now, not knowing at all what I'm talking about, and I could make something up and you wouldn't know the difference. Because here is the rule book. That's the rule book of the National Football League. This thing's so complicated that I could bluff anybody. I could win that. What I do is really kind of mindless. To tell you the truth, fun, but mindless. I shouldn't. Yeah, you know that. There goes my contract with the Fox too. To tell you the truth, just cut my pay in half when they hear this. But you know, I think this is out of the paper this morning, and I'm going to open this up to questions because I just think we all have to think a little bit about, you know, how we view sports. And you guys that have baseball on your – I played in this – at Buckshaw Stadium before you had this beautiful field, man. I played with the slow, rusty bucket weeks. And, you know, and you have a responsibility. And you know, and everything is about winning and losing. We all understand that. But it's how you, too, project yourself. Because believe it or not, there are kids running around here in this area that are going to watch baseball games, and all you guys, and it's soccer, whatever it is, you've got to project yourself in a positive model. Because the minute you step on an athletic field, I don't care what sport you're in college or even in high school, you are a role model. And you're going to end up being a role model to some kid. And if you want him to reflect favorably and act favorably, then you act favorably too. But I thought this was good in the paper today. This is my friend Judy Batista from the New York Times wrote this article. It was in the Sacramento Bee, and it was about how Goodell did not reduce any of the punishment on the Saints. Surprise. Like, that was a big surprise, especially after hearing what Greg Williams said. But in the letter, he writes, and this is the commish. The club and the individuals will be expected to cooperate in any further proceedings. There will be further proceedings. They're going on right now about the players. Jonathan Vilma, I don't think he'll suspend a lot of people, but he'll fine people. I think there's a good chance he'll suspend Vilma. But he expects them to participate and cooperate in the future proceedings. But here was the thing that I liked. And assist in the development and implementation of programs to instruct players and coaches at all levels on principles of player safety, fair play, and sportsmanship. So he's telling the Saints, if you have any notion of us lowering that draft choice in 2013 to maybe the fifth or sixth round, and if you have any notion of having Sean Payton, if you want any of your $7 million back, then you will develop a program with us to teach others. Because it's interesting. NFL, high school, college. Just because of this talk. Coaches' code of ethics, full page. Officials' code of ethics, full page. College book, full page, coaching ethics. Nowhere. So it's time to teach some ethics in the league. They may mention it in some club operations book, but it certainly isn't where it should be. And the only thing it says here about ethics, as I read the book, really, it says that the National Football League deprecates the use of feigning injuries. I would say to you, probably most people that play it and coaches don't probably know what deprecates means, which, by the way, I didn't either when I first read it. But anyway, so it's at a crossroads. Our game's at a crossroads, not a crosswords, but at a crossroads. And I think it's going to be interesting to see where it goes from here. I mean, I do think it's at that point now with a commissioner that's pretty popular, that I think he'll continue to carry this on to attempt to make sure the game is played fairly and to protect the players as much as they can. So with that, I'm going to take your written questions. David, I already went way over, but I have a hard time saying hello in 30 minutes, much less give a talk.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, for very insightful comments and all. And we have a number of questions coming in. Please continue to pass them up, and we'll pose them to Mike as many as we can. Question here about the new rules that actually have been adopted on the field for the sake of player safety. Could you say a little what those rules are? Do you think they've been effective in enhancing player safety on the field? Do you think they've had any effect also, either in the locker room or with coaches?
Well, first of all, yes, I do think they've had an effect, only because I watch every game. And the big thing is, the big rule changes have come as to what they call defenseless players. These are players that are deemed not to be able to protect themselves. And what they've said, if a player can't protect himself, then don't hit him in the head or neck area, period. Hit him somewhere else. If you're a quarterback, hit him above the knee, but don't hit him in the head or neck area. And if they're defenseless, don't ever lead with this. Don't lead with your helmet and hit him anywhere, because if you do, it's a foul. So you're protecting, and these rule changes have really come over the last 10 years, basically, and continue to be brought in. There was one more brought in this year, although it's not one that's is all that recognizable, because it involves a crackback block. But anyways, you're protecting both players. I mean, that's what they want to do. They want to protect the guy from getting hit in this area, and then they want to protect the guy that does this. Because if you do this and you make contact, you're at risk. So, and I have seen now, I have seen many times against defenseless receivers, players letting up and not delivering the blows with the helmet. I've seen it now more and more. And why? Well, money talks. The penalty flag talks too. But those $40,000 fines that players say, ah, who cares? I make a lot of money. Well, maybe you don't. But when you go home, and when you show up at home, and your wife said, where's that $40,000? You know, life at home ain't that good. And it is making a difference. It is making a difference. And I know from watching all these plays that players are using their helmet less. I also know that the league is looking to go further. And they're looking to even try to protect the runner from being hit and trying to tell the runner, you can't lower your head. And, you know, when you're taking on a defender, and Rusty will tell you, when it comes to tackling versus runner, it's usually the guy that gets low, that gets the lowest that wins, and that involves lowering your head. It's a slippery slope, but I do think they're making good progress, and it is making a difference.
Question here from the audience about officiating, and you've identified different parties involved here, Mike, obviously the players, coaches, NFL executives. Can officials act differently on the field to change the course of a game in the way they haven't yet? Do you think they need to be more proactive? And what are influences on officials on the field that sort of perhaps inhibit better officiating?
Well, can they act any differently, or are they acting any differently? The answer to that question, I guess, would be yes. And for two reasons. And number one, because even when I was on the field in the late 90s or 90, 96 and 97, you never thought of hits on defenseless players. You never thought about that. You saw these vicious hits, but they weren't really fouls. And so you really ignored them. And even with it, when they became fouls, it wasn't one that was really strictly enforced until just a few years ago. And so now you take these officials, and you're taking officials and you're asking them to make a judgment on something that happens in 1/26th of a second. You're asking them to make a judgment on something that they've never had to make a judgment on before. And it is brutally tough. And here's what happens, which makes the league look, or makes the officials look bad. And it's too bad, but it's the way it is. The league says to them, and the book says, if you have any doubt as to whether the act might be illegal, call it. In 1/26th of a second, when you see a guy get hit up near the head or neck area, you have doubt. And so the league says, throw the flag. And the league says, we don't care if you're wrong, because we're trying to change the culture. Now, all fine and dandy, and I don't have a problem with that, except who takes the beating? The officials. You know, all of a sudden, when we're all watching it, we watch it in slow motion. It's not a hit to the head. It's actually in the shoulder. But this poor official thought it might have been, so he does what he's told to do and throws the flag. So they've made it tougher on officials. But thankfully, I would say, by the time that officials get to that level, they don't, you know, they're not affected by the, you know, by the criticism that they get. I mean, back in Ravenswood area back in 1971, you learned early on about criticism, especially when they're coming from parents who are standing on the sidelines, you know, when their kid gets hit. You know, you learn to deal with that stuff. But it is difficult.
Question here about your Fox colleague and former Dallas Cowboy quarterback Troy Aikman, who said recently that the league should perhaps go with less protection for players, maybe go back to leather helmets. The questioner asked, which would lessen the gladiator mentality, thus possibly making proper technique more important. Do you think that would be the direction to go in terms of improving the safety of the game?
That only proves one thing, That's that he had 8 concussions in his career, because that's about the only reason you would say something like that. Once you equip someone, you can never go back. Never. I mean, what you really ought to do is you really ought to be doing as much research as you can possibly do to make sure that you have the best and safest equipment as possible. But you can't take a helmet off a guy. I mean, that's all you do, take a helmet off a guy, he gets killed. He'd sue you and the league for every penny that you ever had. It is kind of appalling, though, when you look at it and say, you know, the league, you're not required to wear hip pads or thigh pads or knee pads. As they are in lower levels, you know, and players don't want to wear them because they make them a tad bit slower, especially skill players, you know. And you look and say, yeah, but okay, you can protect yourself a little bit. And we saw some pretty significant injuries where a helmet hit a knee, a runner's helmet or a tackler's helmet hit the knee of the runner. And without a pad, he had ended up with a concussion, you know. And the other thing is there's about 3 or 4 different helmets out there, and players get their choice of what they want to wear in terms of helmets. And some are not as safe as others. But there's some legal ramifications that are involved that don't allow the league to say, this is the helmet that you are going to wear. So you're not going to go backwards. You're never going to go backwards in player safety, which is, by the way, that's why anytime you go, they proposed a rule this year, crackback block, to protect the guy that gets crackback blocked. And saying making him defenseless so you can't hit him in the head or neck area. The minute they propose a player safety rule, it's going to pass. It's going to pass. The 31, the Raiders will vote against it, but the but the other 31 teams will vote for it. That's just an automatic.
Mike, you mentioned, of course, the audio of Coach Williams that was just put out in the last several days. Were you surprised by that audio? What was your reaction in hearing it? And behind that question, too, I'm wondering, people have said that they don't think the Saints are probably the only team with a bounty system. What is your sense of that? Are bounties more widespread in the NFL than we'd like to think?
No, I don't think they are more widespread. I think this was the exception to the rule. I think that you motivate people in different ways. I do think that there are players that try to take out players. I mean, that's just the way it is. If you go back in the olden days of football, you know, I think the game was so totally different that, you know, even in the sportsmanship thing, you know, you didn't do the crap the players do now, because if you did, it would get taken care of on the field. You didn't dare. They'd get you on the field. But nowadays, with the way football is and with 26 cameras and in a department in New York that looks at every single play and fines you for your illegal acts, you can't really clean it up anymore. You clean it up, and then you end up with the $15,000 fine or the $20,000 fine. So it's an aggressive game. You know, are there the bounties out there? I don't think there are. Are there players that say, hey, this guy had a concussion, let's hit him hard, let's intimidate him a little bit? Sure. But I don't think they're paying people. Did it surprise me that Greg Williams did it, said what he said in the 49er game? No, I guess. I've known him for a while. Probably doesn't surprise me. I mean, just look at where he's been. You got to do is look at, follow his vapor trail. Tennessee, Washington, Buffalo, New Orleans. The defenses have all been aggressive, really aggressive, to the edge. It's my complaint about ethics, which I didn't get in it. Coaching ethics. Coaching ethics, see, to me, you ought to play by the rules. Coaches try to circumvent the rules. They do. If you can get away with it, we'll do it. Is that the right attitude? I don't know. If we can cheat and get away with it, we'll do it. You don't like to hear that. League wouldn't like to hear me say that, but it's true. And Greg Williams just played so aggressively, and he just was known for that.
Well, I think it seems as if some people have been inspired by your story in the 71 story of coaching in East Palo Alto and all. But more specifically, a question here is, could you talk a little more about the process of becoming specifically an NFL official? And also, if you could answer in the course of that, what is your feeling about women officiating in the NFL?
talk about two different questions. What's it take to become? I think I was pretty typical. I thought about telling the story, so I'll tell it quickly. I won't tell the dragged out version. But, you know, you start officiating and you get hooked on it. You think about working in the NFL. I mean, that's the ultimate. So I started in 71 and did 14 years of Division I college football after doing junior college and small college. And so 25 years, I finally got that call from the NFL saying that, you know, you become a finalist. That's what they said. And so then they put you through a whole rigor of tests. It's unbelievable. The first thing they said to me, you're going to have a psychologist come out and talk to you. Which probably they wanted to check my ethics, I guess, to some degree. And they sent a guy out and we spent 3 hours in a hotel room and he's asking me everything about my life and my parents and my upbringing, very little about football. Gave me some written test where you have to fill in the form thing. And so I got done with that. And then a week later, an FBI guy called me. This is all about integrity of the game. An FBI called me and said, I'd like to meet with you. You want to go over all your finances and stuff like that because you don't want people in the league that are in debt for obvious reasons. And so this FBI guy came out and talked to me. It was pretty incredible. And we talked about things. And he said to me, no problem. You're great. I'm not going to have to do anything more. It's great. No issues at all. 3 days later, our neighbor across the street came over and said, are you in trouble? I said, well, why? Well, an FBI guy came to our door and was asking questions about you and one of them, like you had parties in the middle of the night or cars drove up in the middle of the night and then took off and canvassed my neighborhood asking questions, which come to find out when I went to work for the league, that's what we do. That's how careful we are. And then I had to go back to New York for a session with all the supervisors, and they ask you all different types of questions. And of course, then I had to go to Europe to, at that time, they had NFL Europe to work over there, and they watched you. But the funny part was, is that when I finally got the call in April of 96 that they were actually going to take me in, my biggest fan in the world was my dad. And he was an official. He worked high school football and he worked some football, college football in what was then called the PCAA, which had San Jose State and Fresno State. He worked Santa Clara games too, which was probably not very ethical since his son was going to the school, but he didn't, I think he used a different name, but he was so into my getting into the NFL that when I got a call that I got in, he opened every piece of mail I got from the league before I did, you know. And when I finally got the call, I had to call him. They kind of told you not to share it with anybody except your immediate family. So I thought I'd call him. And he'd left and was going out to Van Buskirk Golf Course in Stockton, California. And I called on the head pro. I said to the head pro, Ray Claver, is my dad there? And he goes, not yet. I said, well, tell him to call me as soon as he gets there. And I said, it's not an emergency. Everything's okay. So 5 minutes later, my dad calls and I said, Dad, I got in. He goes, you got in what? I said, Dad, I just got a call from Jerry Seaman. I got in the NFL. This is what I got. Silence. Silence. And after about 15 seconds, he said, well, there's son, he said, I just want you to remember one thing. I was in the store in Stockton with tears in my eyes because I knew he was going to tell me how proud he was of me after all this crap that I had been through. I knew he was. He said, son, I just want to tell you one thing. Pause. And he said, don't screw the 49ers. And he hung up. He hung up the phone and walked out, he said, to the first tee and hit the longest drive of his life on the first tee. Second part, as far as women, hey, I'd love to see women in the NFL. And you have right now, you have probably, you're probably 2 years away from seeing your first, who's a woman that's working in Conference USA. You know, it's hard because it's more like baseball. It's not like basketball that has women's professional basketball and you have women that are working at that level already. There's no women's professional football unless you consider the lingerie league, you know, which is not, well, I did want to work in the lingerie league, officiate one of those games, but I have. There's no real mechanism to get the type of training that you get, but they are. You know, I'm kind of one of those goofy guys because when I get on an airplane and a woman comes on and says, "This is your captain speaking," I'm like really happy. I really am because I know she's a hell of a lot more conscientious than that male pilot who was probably drinking the night before, you know. And so I think when they do get in the league, as long as they are qualified and as long as they can do the job, I think it will be great to have them in the league. Much like Violet Palmer in the NBA, who I think does an absolutely terrific job. If you've got the ability, then hopefully they will be there, and they will.
Mike, without prejudice to the many calls you've gotten right in your life as a referee and official, could you speak about any calls that you've regretted over the time, any particular plays or incidents or games that you remember that you wished you kind of had gone another way?
It's interesting. Somebody asked me that question not too long ago. They said, what was your best call you ever made? I said, you know, I don't know. As an official, you don't remember the good ones you make. You remember the bad ones. The bad ones stick to you like glue, and they never go away. I mean, I wasn't on the field very long. I was only on the field in the NFL for 2 years before they moved me into the office. Now, some would say there was a reason for a move. But my only playoff game was in my second year, and I worked the game. It was a divisional game. Denver, the Broncos played at Kansas City. And early in the game, I mean, they ran a simple down and up with McCaffrey, Ed McCaffrey, the receiver, and there was the most blatant illegal contact against the Kansas City defender. I don't remember who it was on my side of the field. My guy, McCaffrey, was the wide. It was my guy. I was the side judge. My God. I mean, it was the highest level I've ever worked, and it was the most pressure I've ever been under, and I literally froze. I mean, I swallowed the olive, every terminology you can think of. I mean, I choked, and I didn't call it. And of course, I'm even worse. I'm on the Denver sideline, so they saw it. So then they came after me, and it's like after it was all said and done, you know, you process the whole thing through your head, you know, 30 seconds after it's done, and you think, oh my God. God, well, you can't throw it now. You know, you blew it already, and I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget how I got chewed out by Shanahan, and I never forget there just thinking, ah, dang, I deserve that. I mean, that's just the way it is. I don't remember the good ones. I mean, you know, the thing is, it's amazing about officiating is, do you realize that those people are making decisions in 1/26th of a second? And you know, you don't see everything. That's what's amazing. You ask one of these good officials, my God, I play in the sideline. What'd you see? I don't know. I don't know. It's all instinct. It's all a feel. It becomes a feel. That's why people say to me, you know, you got to get those old guys off the field. Really? Really? I'll take an old guy with the ability to see and process against a young guy who's strapping and can run that field. Boy, he could do that 100-yard dash, boy, in about 9.8. But he wouldn't know a false start from a delay of game. You know, officiating is a mental process, not a physical process. And it's amazing. It's in my mind, I'm a little bit prejudiced. I still am, even though I'm a media now. I still think they do an unbelievably good job. Unbelievably good job, and I'm talking football, and I'm talking basketball, and I'm talking baseball. I think they do an incredible job.
What if we might circle back a little more to talking about issues raised by the Saints situation, kind of competition more generally. And I was reading something by Jim Thompson of the Positive Coaching Alliance up at Stanford, who thinks a lot about competitive sports matters. And he was talking in an essay about the way we think about competition today, he thinks has changed. And, for instance, Coach Williams in that audio spoke in the sort of language of war, that we're at war. The other team is the enemy. This is about domination of the other team, not our own excellence. Would you agree that that's become, in a way, a sort of culture in the NFL? And if so, what can we do about it?
Yeah, I don't know that that's changed. I mean, I think that, you know, I think domination has been in the league. Attempting to dominate your opponent has been in the league forever. I mean, you go back and look at this game, and you look at how rough and tough this game was before. I think it was worse then than it is now. I mean, I think you do try to dominate. I mean, I don't know that I necessarily agree that. I think maybe it's a little bit deeper than my thought process normally is about competition. I mean, I think competition is good, and I think you try to beat your opponent's head up, and I think you try to dominate your opponent. I mean, you know, in this day and age, you know, you've seen the Giants up 6-0 against the Arizona Diamondbacks with Matt Cain on the mound, and then they lose 7-6 because they didn't dominate. They didn't shit. They had runners on base. They had runners on base in the sixth and seventh inning where they could have blown that game open, and they didn't. And then God bless Barry Zito, huh? The guy thrown to the wolves. Everybody said, that guy's got it. 19 innings of preseason pitching allowed 43 base runners. And everybody said that he was going to get killed yesterday. He might have single-handedly turned around the season, even though it's only game four. I think you try to dominate your opponent. I don't really have any thought.
Also, I'm wondering if we might just go back with the Saints. Yesterday, the NFL announced the punishment. They reaffirmed the punishment for the Saints. Do you think the punishment fits the crime there? Do you think the punishment should have been more extensive for the Saints than it was?
Yeah, I thought it should have been more extensive. I didn't think the money was very much. $500,000 to a team is not very much. I mean, you know, a total really, you know, I mean, the Patriots paid $500,000 for filming the other team's plays. And the Patriots also got docked a first-round draft choice. You know, I thought it might have been higher. I certainly wasn't shocked about Peyton getting suspended for a year. And I wasn't shocked about Mickey Loomis, their GM, getting suspended for 8 games or 7 games, or Joe Vitt, who was also, he's a former head coach and was also on the defensive side of the ball with Greg Williams. None surprised me. I just a little bit about the money thing did. I thought it might be more. And back to my point, Goodell was going to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And when you're going to do that, you better be severe. You better be severe. And while most people think this was incredibly severe, I'm kind of the one that thinks that it could have been a little bit more. But I think he proved his point. I don't think that you'll be hearing about this unless they uncover something from the past again that somebody else had done. But I think they just put the sheriff just put the fear of God into everybody in the game.
Like you pointed to the lack of ethics training in the NFL rule book there. If you could imagine sort of a program going forward to sort of change the culture, instill more ethics in terms of coaching, players in the field, what would be your 3 key parts of such a program?
Well, I mean, first one would be to play by the rules. I mean, I think that'd be a good start, I think. I mean, and I'm not being sarcastic. I mean, because Buckets here, he coached, and I'm sure he coached again. You know, I mean, you played by the rules, but you played to beat the rules too. I mean, that's just the way it is. You play in any game, really. It seems like, but certainly in football, you play to kind of win and to skirt the rules the best way that you can. And if the officials can't see something, you'll do it. Just the way it is, Buckets. I'd also like to think that we'd look at the respect factor, the respect to your opponents and the respect to the game itself, which I think the whole sportsmanship thing has gotten to be nasty over the last number of decades, really, where players are just showboating. I think, and lastly, I think that, I would go to the high school book in the coach's code of ethics. I wish I had put this one in the NFL, but I wish I could have figured out that. Is that the coach shall respect and support contest officials. The coach shall not indulge in conduct which would incite players or spectators against the officials. Well, I'd like to enforce that. I mean, Buckets, did you ever yell at an official? Yeah, right. I'd love to have been with this code of ethics and to throw the flag and say 15 yards for unethical conduct from the coach on the sidelines. But it's all about respect. There needs to be, there needs to be respect for the game, respect for the players, opponents, teammates, coaches, and officials. We need to have more respect, which is lacking.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope you all enjoyed this afternoon's program brought to you by the Markela Center for Applied Ethics, the Santa Clara University Athletic Department, and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank very much Mike Pereira, Fox Sports analyst and Bronco 72, our audience here at Santa Clara University, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.